versus Scott F. Anderson. Mr. Anderson, you're representing yourself. You have 25 minutes to address the court, and you will get 5 minutes in rebuttal. And Mr. Weigel, you will have 30 minutes. You may proceed, counsel. Who's first here? Okay, I have Mr. Anderson as first. I apologize. You may proceed first. I change everything I said. You have 25 minutes and 5 minutes in a rebuttal.
Mr. Anderson, a bit of a startup.
All right, no problem.
And good morning, Chief and Justices. And the opportunity to discuss, you know, a lawyer regulation case is always an honor and a privilege. This is a sanctioned case. Whether Attorney Scott Anderson committed 3 counts of professional misconduct is not at issue. It's a given, and the facts of the case and the record are clear. Was
it stipulated as such?
There was a stipulation of facts that is in the record.
Okay.
And that stipulation was specifically incorporated within the referee's report by reference within the referee's report. The referee also found a number of those facts. Mr. Anderson freely admitted his commission of misconduct during initial testimony at the hearing.
This only involves one client, is that right?
This is a one-client matter. Although it's 3 counts, it's really what I'll call neglect and failures to communicate. There's really 2 areas in which the misconduct occurred. And I have a bit of an ambitious agenda for the 25 minutes. I'd like to discuss 4 or 5 things. Attorney Anderson's prior discipline and progressive discipline, why OLR is appealing from this referee's report, why a 50-day suspension is, in our view, the right result, why OLR is not seeking restitution, and why remorse and contrition, which are present here, don't negate the facts in the record. The facts justify the suspension sought by the OLR director. Attorney Anderson was admitted to practice 24 years ago, practices in Milwaukee. Within the past 10 years, he has already received professional discipline on 3 separate occasions. One of those, the middle reprimand, involved 3 client matters. So we're talking 3 prior reprimands, 5 prior client matters. This would be his 4th. Briefly, the 1999 private reprimand was imposed for neglect and for his failures to communicate with his client. That's in the record at Exhibit 3. His 2004 public reprimand involved 3 client matters. In one of them, neglect and failures to communicate. In the second, neglect and failing to obey a court order. In the third, neglect and failures to communicate. When I say neglect, that means a failure to reasonably and diligently represent the client. It's a SCR 20:1.3 violation, and I have shortened that to that term of neglect. The 3rd reprimand, the 2005 reprimand, was for not properly communicating about fees and ignoring the client's attempts to fire him, and it was for neglect and failures to communicate. The 2005, the 3rd public reprimand, was imposed on September 30th of 2005, and the timing is important. Because that imposition occurred when Attorney Anderson was representing Mr. Eggsy Tatum Jr. in the case at bar. There was a case that actually I handled and then went to oral argument, disciplinary proceedings against Nussberger. It was decided in 2006. And in that case, this court said the fact that respondent was in the process of finalizing a consent reprimand when he committed new misconduct confirms the need for a sanction stronger than another reprimand. In that case, back's different, but in that case, the court imposed a 60-day suspension. So the instant case is not only, you know, Mr. Anderson's 4th go-round, this time, as in each of the past 3 cases, the violations consist of clear-cut neglect and of multiple and pervasive failures to communicate. And it occurred while he was in the process of being disciplined in 2005. The court utilizes progressive discipline. I believe that Ms. Falk's brief mentioned the Converse case, which is oft-cited for that. Progressive discipline here is warranted. The write a brief differently, and I did not author OLR's brief nor try the case. I think that OLR's counsel did an excellent job at those. But I'm here actually because of workload scheduling concerns, perhaps, and happy to address these matters. And I thought, gee, this case reminds me of a matter that I handled some time ago. It was in the late 90s, a Madison attorney. His name was John Louderman. The court issued a decision in 99. He'd had three prior private reprimands for conduct similar to what we were accusing him in the fourth case. And like here, he and his attorney stipulated to the misconduct and the facts and argued sanction. They wanted another private. And this court imposed a public reprimand stating, this attorney has established a history of neglecting his client's matters. A higher level of discipline was called for to impress upon him the seriousness of his professional obligations to clients and to deter him from engaging in similar misconduct in the future. Now, the court at that time didn't use the term progressive discipline because it really wasn't in wide use. What that decision said to my ears, and it resonated as I looked at the briefs and the facts of this case, is enough is enough. You know, lower level discipline hasn't altered your behavior to properly protect the public and the profession, and to ensure you modify your behavior, we're going to step it up a notch. And those are obviously my words and not yours, but Mr. Anderson's situation is
I'm going to accept for the moment that we're going to have progressive discipline, but we may disagree as to whether it's progressive enough. I'd like you to talk about the referee. Referee recommended restitution in the sum of, what, $10,872?
And 50 cents, yes.
Okay. And said you got a year to pay it in 365 days, right?
Yes.
And then said if you fail to make the payment, your license is suspended for 60 days.
Commencing, I guess, on the 366th day after the court's final order. Yes.
I suppose the guy can't pay it. The lawyer cannot pay it. Mr. Anderson can't pay it. Can you put him in 60-day suspension? Is that for property?
You know, debtor's prisons are abolished an awful long time ago, and I don't
think... Oh, but he's not in prison. This is a sanction of
It is. Maybe if I may address that, and I don't at all mean to duck the question, but by telling you why OLR appealed, and also why OLR did not seek and does not seek a restitution order.
I think that's a good idea.
Okay.
Because it doesn't seem appropriate on its face.
I
say that you can't collect for the client $10,872 if he's out. Now, the question I had is he's out much more than that, maybe.
Maybe. We don't know from the record. You know, the referee made clear findings of fact and incorporated that stipulation by reference, and he found the misconduct. But the disposition, quite frankly, OLR felt was inappropriate enough that it caused us to appeal. And the recommendation is just as you stated with me through questioning. There's a couple of problems with that. I mean, this type of recommendation, first, it feels, it's analogized, I guess, to maybe a criminal, we're going to impose a sentence, stay the sentence, instead put you on probation. I mean, it's kind of what it is. And a precedent-based issue that OLR has with that construct is that this court does not impose probation in attorney discipline cases. I believe that's addressed in the brief. I think of the Maury case, which is a case I was going to discuss in some detail at some point later, but it's a 2004 case where the court said what they did in Illinois includes elements we don't generally do in Wisconsin, including the stay of all but a part of the sanction, and placing Attorney Maury on probation. In the brief was the Hoffman case, and this court clearly stated, we do not defer license suspensions in this state. I can talk more about that. There's the Fay case and Greenwald and others, but let me get back to your question and my answer. So we are concerned about that structure. But a more important concern, very frankly, is that if adopted, This kind of a result would send the message to the public and to the bar that an attorney can avoid an adverse effect on his or her license simply by paying money. In other words, perhaps your question asked about what about the attorney who can't pay, and isn't that act working in unfairness? We are worried about the attorney that can pay and will pay and think that they should be able to pay in order to avoid an adverse licensing consequence.
Well, the rich can avoid it and the poor can't.
Well, and that's not how this court works, and if you pay, you shouldn't be able to avoid a suspension. It would be otherwise appropriate. You know, if you pay, you can even avoid a reprimand. That smacks of saying, and I don't mean disrespect to the referee who gave a good and considered opinion and assisted the court with his report, but it smacks of saying to us, you can buy your way out. That's the wrong message to send. The potential effect of that could be a significant detrimental alteration in the perception of the integrity of the system.
You're not necessarily buying your way out. You're just going to, the sanction is different. The sanction is not for violating the code. The sanction of 60 days is failing to pay. That's what bothers me. You move the sanction from the discipline into the amount of money.
We're both bothered, and the bother that the burr under my saddle is a little bit different than under yours, Chief, but
I think that matter. My saddle is more important.
Yes, it is. In either event, I think that the construct has difficulties, and you know, the court can issue a monetary penalty. That's available to you under 2116.
Well, let's get to the monetary penalty.
Okay.
What's the matter with them? You're looking a gift horse in the mouth. You're saying
your
we don't
saddle.
With your saddle, right? if we're going to stay with the horse analogy, you're saying, hey, don't impose $10,000. You're taking his side. $10,872. He's willing to pay that. I understand what his position is.
I will try not to take too long to wade through this, but bear with me, please. We did not suggest that a restitution order was appropriate given what we had investigatively in this case, and I would suggest to the court that a restitution order isn't appropriate given the record that now exists in the case. The OLR director developed four factors, four criteria, each of which must be met before we will, as a practice or as a policy, recommend restitution.
What's the basis of your policy?
Sitting down and thinking real hard about what seems to be fair and the right thing to do.
Is it in the statute? Or is it
in the code?
Okay, that's what I'm asking you.
However, there is something in the statute and the rule that also might arguably prohibit or render inappropriate the restitution.
Let's start with that, if you don't mind.
I don't mind. The court had imposed restitution in a number of attorney disciplinary cases historically, and the construct you used was the idea that one of the available sanctions was monetary payment, and that's still an available sanction under 2116. I'm sorry that I don't have the timing, but several years ago, and when the Client Security Fund wanted to make sure that there was additional reference and protection under the rule, the court revisited somewhat the 21 SCR 2116, the discipline rule, as far as types of discipline that can be imposed, and you made very specific reference, specifically authorizing restitution. And within that specific reference, and it's sub 2M, and I can grab my green book, I don't want to misquote the rule, but it refers to money or property misappropriated or misapplied. And yes, I am taking Mr. Anderson's position. He did not have these funds under his control. He did not misappropriate them. He did not take them and misapply them.
I disagree with you. I believe that we've had cases, but I can't point to any because I'm not prepared to do that. But I believe we've had cases, a situation like this. Attorney represents a client in a small claims action. There's a return date for a small claims action. The attorney totally bungles it, doesn't show up. The client's the defendant. A judgment against the client is entered for in the amount of $212.12, okay? I mean, By that I mean there is a liquidated amount. It's a sum specific. For some reason, the judge isn't willing to reopen the case. The defendant, client, is responsible then because of the attorney's total negligence and failure to communicate, let's say, throw that in, for that amount, $212.12. I think that money was never in the hands, as you say. The funds to be restored were in the respondent lawyer's direct control. They weren't. But I think that is a liquidated amount. It is a sum certain. It is directly attributable to the misconduct of the lawyer, and I think that should be a subject of restitution.
And I understand, and certainly the court's prerogative is to assess these situations, to order restitution, and we honor that.
You disagree with that. You say, it has to be only when it's in the respondent lawyer's direct control, in their hands.
That's one of three reasons. I only have four factors. Three of them weren't met. One of three reasons we don't think restitution was merited in this case. And respectfully, Justice Bradley, and I understand that feeling and that the court wants to make a victim whole. I'm not recalling a case specifically like the one you mentioned. I am recalling a case where there were incidental or what I call consequential damages imposed as a restitution order. It was a one-time matter. I feel that it's kind of an anomaly in disciplinary cases. But in 1999, in a case involving Nick Grapsis, an immigration attorney, there was a lack of clarity about what should be done about restitution, and the court sent it back to the referee and said, how much? And the referee wrote back the next day and said, cost her $1,505 to fly back to Taiwan and back to try to remedy the situation. And the court ordered Attorney Grapsis to pay that amount to the client. Other than that case, and I'm not, never say never, I'm not thinking of a case in which the court is ordering consequential damages. But again, there are multiple reasons, and I think reasons in the record. I guess I'm spending more of my time defending Mr. Anderson. Why I don't think a restitution order is...
No, but restitution is an important aspect, and you've been, in effect, told in every case you ought to say why you're not seeking it. You can have a case where there's a botch for a plaintiff. The plaintiff sues the client, the attorney, for malpractice. You have a trial, and it turns out that the malpractice, the claim that the plaintiff's lawyer botched was $25,000. And that you got a malpractice judgment for $25,000.
Please let me talk about that in that hypothetical. Okay.
Now we also have a discipline case involving that.
We have discipline case, and yes, $10,872 is a discreet, clear amount, a figure.
As to amount, not necessarily as to liability in this record.
Yeah, not on this record. Well, and it's resulted from a default, basically, from Mr. Anderson's failure to, on his client's behalf, oppose a government forfeiture action.
Is it clear that he had the notice with regard to the first forfeiture, he being Attorney Anderson?
I believe in the stipulation, and I would have to defer to that, and I apologize for any lack of knowledge of parts of the record, that it was pretty clear, and he admitted he failed to answer and failed to respond to the government's forfeiture action, and that was a basis of the liability that he's admitted. So I assume the notice part was clear. Well, let me get to the amount part. Now, that may be a discrete amount, but it's not on this record susceptible of being, you know, ascertained as the proper or the most fair amount, because, Chief, in your example, well, let me put it this way. There's $48,000 plus seized from Mr. Tatum, and there's these series of notices and abilities to put in a claim or contest that. And as to the two claims that Mr. Anderson actually did timely contest, because there were several he did not, as to those two, the government starts a civil forfeiture action against property, against this $10,000 sum. And then Mr. Anderson doesn't file an answer. So the $10,000 figure is the amount from this one proceeding, but he also failed to timely file claims as to the balance, as to like $48,000. If you're inclined to make him pay $10,000, there's nothing to say that he should not pay $48,000.
Mr. Leica, the reason I gave you my example is I had a judgment, I had a fixed amount, I had fixed liability, but it does not fit under money or property. misappropriated or misapplied.
So
it's a malpractice case.
Let me get right back to your example. Malpractice, $25,000. When that client sues that attorney for malpractice, she has to show the attorney's culpability, and that's done. And when she does that, does she automatically get a check for $25,000? No. That in that malpractice action, she has to prove that she would be entitled to recovery, that she would have won the underlying case. And
Mr. Weigel, she won it. She's got a judgment for $25,000. She's now in discipline. That is, the lawyer is in discipline. In that case, are you going to give restitution for $25,000 as part of the discipline case? That's my question. It's very simple. It's really a simple question. And I put it that way, so I got... That's why I'm dealing with your $48,000, your $10,000. You should be answering me, I think, that in discipline, you would not view it as restitution because it was not money or property misappropriated or misapplied. But you don't want to answer that way. Or do you? If, that was your first point, wasn't it?
The answer
is she wasn't getting $25,000 in my example.
I'm sure my answer is...
The answer is that in the restitution, no restitution in the discipline case for the $25,000.
My answer is that now under the court's rule that authorizes restitution, it authorizes the court to do so when property is misapplied or misappropriated. And it doesn't seem to me that your situation, even where there's a judgment,
right, fits
that... your rules, but that rule-given authority. And that's not the situation that we have here, Chief. And that's what I wanted to say.
I understand that.
In the malpractice action, we have the culpability, but we don't know that Mr. Tatum would have been successful in his action against the government to stop them from seizing $10,872. Or he might have been successful to part of it, the cash part of it, not some other part. There's nothing in the record that would support properly that as being a clear, ascertainable amount for you.
Well, is there enough in the record to support $10,872.50?
What I am positing to the court is no, that there is not. Wasn't that seized as part of a drug arrest? Yeah, you know, there were a couple of drug convictions, and this is a drug matter. Mr. Tatum testified from custody where he is now. He also testified as to, I think, being on disability, but, you know, shattered hip, poor health and such. But somehow there was $48,000 floating out there, and the government went after it. And it would be up to Mr. Tatum, represented by Mr. Anderson, to contest that if he could do so successfully.
To show that it came from a legitimate source.
Right. And there's just nothing in the record of this disciplinary case that says that he would have been able to contest that successfully. Now, was there a failure to file an answer? Was there... You know, failure to promptly represent him? Was it neglect? Yes. But
admitted that.
You know, yeah, but the amount? I think that Mr. Anderson has voiced and expressed significant contrition. He's talked about the impact that this would have on him. But you know, and I don't at all doubt that, and I don't at all, you know, he is a sincere man, and this does not at all involve dishonesty. He made that point. You know, most attorneys are very remorseful for their misconduct, or at least aspects of their misconduct. I mean, we've handled hundreds of these actions. Most attorneys are fully cooperative with the system and with the litigation. Anybody would have an adverse impact on their pocketbook by having to pay $10,000. And that stuff does not negate the conduct here that merits the suspension. And so I kind of circle back to that. And what I do want to emphasize, because my yellow light is on, is that there are facts in this case that are found in the stipulation. Boy, I was particularly interested in reading the stipulation, which is in the record, I think, at R12, between numbers like maybe 8 and 20, because Mr. Anderson would say, and this is why I say this is a problem case and not just, it's a little neglect, a little failure to communicate, maybe a reprimand or so. He would say... and testified, there is a strong suppression issue. I think there's a problem with the search. He said on page 39 of the transcript, this guy's got a strong suppression issue. Now this guy, Mr. Tatum, sitting in jail, Attorney Anderson wants to bring the suspension motion in June, asks leave. They say, sure, file a brief in a month. He doesn't. You say we're going to have a hearing on July 15th of 05. Shows up the day of the hearing to serve and file the brief. The court says, well, because of your tardiness, now we're going to have to recast the hearing. And so it gets adjourned to September. And Attorney Anderson did not communicate with his client. And then he moves to adjourn the September hearing without advising his client. So the court adjourns it to January. Docket's a little congested. It goes off to January 18th. Attorney Anderson by phone requests another adjournment. If this is such a strong suppression motion for his guy sitting in jail, I would say he should have gotten that and found a way to get that before the court sometime in that 7-month or 8-month period. Granted, thereafter, there wasn't time for the entire suppression motion. It got put off, and another co-defendant's attorney had a problem. But there are just significant chunks of time where Mr. Anderson did not diligently represent his client or communicate with him. My time for the 25 minutes is up, unless you have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Weigel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Anderson? F. Anderson representing himself.
Morning, counsel.
Morning.
I'm asking you to follow the referee's recommendation. Obviously,
we're willing then. You want 365 days to repay $10,872.50, and if not, you get a 60-day suspension. Is that what you're agreeing to?
I do not want to be suspended. A public reprimand and payment of restitution, yes, I think I deserve that. But I do not want a suspension.
Under any conditions? So you're not really advocating what the referee said?
I accept what the referee said. If I cannot pay that amount within that time period, yes, then I should be suspended. I mean, I accept that. I accept it. I do not want a suspension now, is what I'm saying. I'm not asking for no public reprimand, just pay this amount and be done with it. No, I don't think that's fair. I mean, that isn't fair.
Counselor, if you were suspended, it cost you a whole lot more than $10,000, correct?
It's going to cost my practice. I mean, let alone financially outside of that. This is devastation. I mean, this has been a private hell for the 18 months that it's been going on. I mean, it tears me up. I don't know what, I've got, my practice consists of trial work, primarily on homicide, sexual assault, serious felonies. That's all I do. I've got trials, work that's been going on for, in some cases, over a year, trials coming up that will be wiped out. And I do not know how to deal with that.
I don't know how to deal with your plea here today, because in essence, you're saying, okay, I know I've had a private reprimand for neglect. I know I've had a public reprimand for neglect. I know I've had a public reprimand for neglect. And now I want you to give me another public reprimand, essentially, for neglect. And how do we balance what you're saying when you say it's been a private hell? And I believe you. But how do we balance that with our responsibility as justices to make sure that clients who are served by attorneys who don't neglect their cases? So how do we do that?
And specifically in Mr. Tatum's case, I believe that I was hired to do the drug case, his his felony drug matter in circuit court. During that representation, I was asked to do the forfeiture matter, and I took it on. I should not have taken it on. Because I'm not familiar. I'm familiar somewhat with forfeiture work, but not familiar enough to deal with that, and I should not have. But I believe that I handled his criminal matter in a responsible fashion. The suppression motion and everything that led up to when it got transferred to federal court. Yes, I should have communicated better with him, but the issue was the suppression motion, and that's what we were working on. I do not... What guarantees, what steps have I taken for this not to happen again? I do not do any civil work anymore. No civil work. And I do not go into federal court. I share offices now with another attorney. We're not partners, but I share problems on cases, get advice. Those things that I was not doing during the time of Mr. Tatum's, I do now.
What about this amount of money, $10,872.50? When I took a look at this, it wasn't clear to me if that's really what you owe.
Potentially, because of the mishandling of the forfeiture, I could and I would accept restitution on that total amount. Realistically speaking, on the forfeiture, Mr. Tatum would not have been able to recover that full $48,000.
How much would he have been able to recover? That's an unknown, isn't it?
It's certainly unknown. I believe the $10,000 figure that Mr. Goodman came up with arises out of the two matters that I failed to answer.
Did you have notice of the first matter? That was the April 26th, 2005 deadline for filing claims. I know you're...
Yes.
You did have notice of that. Okay.
What's the basis for saying he probably couldn't have recovered the full $48,000?
There was a significant amount of cash. The exact amount, I can't recall. There was a significant amount of cash found in the home upon the search.
And this was a search for illegal drugs?
Correct. So it was a narcotics search based on a warrant. It was a no-knock warrant. An informant had tipped off that there were drugs in his house and weapons, and indeed, once the police got in, there was. And there was a significant amount of cash that legally we never would have been able to find an alternate source other than drugs.
The reference has been made that Mr. Tatum is serving a lengthy sentence of incarceration. What's his sentence for these offenses?
The matter was dismissed ultimately in state court, and then it was reissued in federal court.
It was part of some kind of agreement, though, wasn't it?
No.
All right. Well, an agreement had initially been offered, something like that. But so what do you get in federal court?
I want to say 17 years.
Incarceration.
I believe so. It's my recollection.
Is this all part of the record?
I believe it's Mr. Tatum testified about it. He's serving a federal prison sentence as a result of the transfer and ultimate conviction in federal court.
Now, he was a veteran, and he was getting some sort of disability, yes, money because of stress, post-traumatic stress, right?
Yes. Vietnam veteran.
Getting, isn't this part of the record? How much was he getting? Per month, per year?
No.
If it's not part of the record, I don't want to know.
No.
Okay.
There were, I made efforts to obtain from the Veterans Administration those documents, and I did not ultimately get those prior to the...
Counselor, how far out do you have trials scheduled for client matters, do you know?
I have trials through July. I have...
July of what? 2009?
I have two homicides set in September 2009.
Are they in what, Milwaukee County Circuit Court?
They're all Milwaukee County Circuit Court.
You say you have two homicides set for September, but you have trials through July. What are they set for in September? A scheduling conference or...
No, I'm just talking about my trial work. I have a trial caseload that is fairly steady up into September.
Okay, that's what I was trying to figure out.
Including those September trial dates.
All right, thank you. And how many of them have been continued?
How many of those have been?
And one of the issues here is you got continuance after continuance because of congestion in Milwaukee County.
Those, how many of these existing trials? One was adjourned. There was a final pretrial on Monday. It was adjourned because new witnesses had arisen. There was a trial date set for Monday. That was adjourned for further investigation. Joint request by both the district attorney and myself because of new witnesses. That was adjourned. The others are trials that essentially these are their first trial dates. They haven't been adjourned for congestion or other reasons.
So if I understand you correctly, you want you think you should get a public reprimand and that you should have restitution in the amount of $10,872.50. And if you don't pay that sum, what happens?
That I be suspended.
Okay. That's how you would do the recommendation of discipline here.
Yes.
As you said, okay.
And, I understand, OLR's position, and this is essentially, Mr. Goodman is asking for a stayed sentence, essentially.
Dan, are you being asked to pay back more than $10,000 of drug money?
Certainly a portion of the total $48,000, he most likely would have been able to recover because there were VA benefits for the post-traumatic stress syndrome. So there would have been a portion that came, money that came from a legitimate source that I mishandled, and Mr. Tatum is out that. I think Mr. Goodman is trying to determine in some fashion that's not clear how much he would have legitimately been able to recover. Some portion of that certainly was not drug money.
Did he have a bank account?
There were bank accounts.
Okay, I mean, if you're getting federal benefits, do they go to the home and are they there in cash, or do they go to a bank?
They were commingled. And there was no, absolutely no way of telling what the large amount of cash that was found in the house, in drawers, in the safe, and was that legitimate money or not? I mean, the presumption is that if it's stored in that fashion, it's going to be drug money. And certainly the assumption is that drug money is going to go into his account.
So no tracing or accounting of VA benefits, what his expenses per month were, so that you know what his savings account is from the VA benefits.
It's nothing like that.
So where does the $10,000 come from? Was it in the government's possession, all of the money?
Yes.
You said, quote, that you would pay the $10,872.50 because you mishandled it. Mishandled the case.
The forfeiture case, absolutely.
Right. And in not trying to get back some of these funds or property that was involved. That's the mishandling. You didn't mishandle the money.
No, I mishandled the forfeiture. I mean, he would have received...
Forfeiture case?
Yes.
He would have received what?
He would have received some money back. I mean, the government conceded some money.
How much?
I think there was a $7,000 plus amount, and I think there was another matter. Those two that I responded, I believe there was a $1,500 to $2,000 matter that the government was willing to at least concede that there was a possibility that that was not drug related. Meaning that, and that's, I am surmising that Mr. Goodman came up with a figure because of those two matters.
They didn't concede it. They were willing to talk about it, or at least think that there's a possibility.
Yes.
Okay. Counsel, just to help me, I guess, become clear, the $10,872.50 is really from the second forfeiture, as I understand it. That was, the forfeiture was $8,900-some in cash and about $1,900 in the bank account. And that's, you add those two numbers together and you get the $10,872.50. But is it really clear that all of that money was drug money? Is it clear? Was any of this money commingled with his benefit money? I'm talking about the $10,872, that combination of around $9,000 in cash, a little more, $1,900.
It's not clear.
It's not clear. And so what I hear you saying is, look, I'm responsible for something. I messed up. The referee came up with this amount by adding that money gotten in the obtained in the second forfeiture. And that's as reasonable as any. And so I'll take that amount, I'll pay that amount, and please don't suspend me. That's what I hear you saying. Do I hear incorrectly?
No. But it's... I believe that it's a fair discipline, that it's a progressive discipline. I am not asking that this matter disappear after 365 days? I mean, it should not. I mean, payment of that money, I mean, does not buy my way out. I mean, there should be a public reprimand at the end. I don't believe that Mr. Goodman is saying that this matter goes away like that. But I believe that, I mean, the nature of this violation, coupled with the significance of the amount, is a progressive penalty and a fair penalty. I mean, it's
the amount of the $10,872 is fair, you think, even though you're not sure how much of that would have been veteran benefit money.
To be frank with you, Justice, if he would have set this at $25,000,
you would have been in here saying, "I'll do it."
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Or $48,000.
Yeah, I understand. I understand.
This amount is not.
Well, I think one of the reasons you might be having a tough time addressing this, even though it's obvious to most of us who are concerned, is you have a duty to Mr. Tatum yet. I mean, you can't be kind of tough for you to sit here and say, yes, he was a drug dealer, all $48,000 would have been properly seized by the government. So you're kind of, it seems to me you're trying very hard and you're trying very hard to walk that fine line between saying, yes, the charges were drug dealing, and he got a lengthy prison sentence. On the other hand, he might have recovered some of it. The exact amount, we don't know. Do I accurately perceive that or not?
It's accurate, and I mean, in thinking about it, in coming here before you, certainly, I mean, that's a problem. I mean, Mr. Tatum and I, we got along. I mean, Mr. Tatum was very gracious at the hearing. And some of that money should be repaid. It's a significant amount for me. I mean, I'm not certainly that he would not have recovered all this amount, but I am responsible for him not recovering some. And the figure was set, and I accept what was set. That amount, just to put the amount in perspective, I would try at public defender rates a homicide case to put normal trial preparation in a week's worth of trial, that would come to about $8,000-$9,000. So that would be one, that financially to me is one homicide case. I mean, it's a significant, in the scheme of my practice, it's a significant financial burden. But in trying to show, and I'm trying to show OLR, and you, I mean, the contrition and to assure that this doesn't happen again, I must take that. I mean, that burden on, even though financially I cannot afford it. And I shouldn't just walk away with a public reprimand. No, I shouldn't. I mean, he is outmoneyed by my failure, my neglect. So certainly this is progressive discipline. I believe I have dealt with this in an honorable fashion. And I've not deceived or held back from OLR. And OLR wants progressive discipline. I believe that this is progressive discipline.
If you assume the burden of paying
$10,000 that you really can't afford, are you digging a hole for yourself in terms of your work obligations, considering your past performance?
The hole to get out of a suspension is insurmountable to me. I put my fees from a homicide case last year toward our daughter's tuition. It was one homicide case that I set that money aside. I put it aside because that was what it had to go for. The same thing here. I would put that money aside. Whatever I had to do to pay that. I mean, whether it puts me in a financial hole, it's not going to affect my practice or how I deal with clients because I have to put this money aside. No, it's not going to affect my practice in that way. It's not going to cause me to neglect matters. I told Mr. Weigel, I am mortified to be here. I am embarrassed. My practice essentially shuts down. I can't recover from that. And I don't believe that this case warrants that. I believe it warrants what Mr. Goodman has proposed here.
As far as the forfeiture matter, what was the exact nature of the mishandling?
I didn't file an answer. I put a notice, but I didn't file an answer. That's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Weigel?
Mr. Weigel, is it in the record what length of time Mr. Tatum received of incarceration?
I don't believe so.
Is it in the record what he was convicted of?
The record basically consists of the stipulation of facts, the evidence, and I
Mr. Tatum testified, though.
It's in the record what he's charged with in the state court. The state court charges were dismissed by agreement so that same day federal court charges would supplant them. I don't have the answer for the federal charges.
Right, but it's fair enough to indicate that they were charges related to not only the possession, but apparently the distribution of illegal narcotics.
I honestly can't answer that. I don't want to go beyond the record.
Fair enough. In the record, though, the police were there on a search warrant for illegal narcotics.
Yes.
Okay.
I understand your argument about why he shouldn't be required to pay restitution, because definitionally, what his client is out doesn't fit within the definition of restitution, right?
It arguably doesn't.
Okay. If I buy that argument, Is there any other mechanism in the code by which he could pay this money to his former client rather than our ordering restitution? He seemed
yes.
willing to do it.
No, the answer is yes.
How would that be?
2116 is the Supreme Court rule which relates to the type of discipline that can be imposed in these proceedings.
Okay.
One of those types, way back when and still now, is called monetary payment. In the past, when the court would order restitution, and people might say, well, why do you have authority to do that? I believe that the construct is, well, that's a monetary payment that we're ordering. And that still exists.
So you
that
could have
form
a
of the sanction still exists. And I'm, yeah.
You could have a monetary payment that isn't a payment to OLR, but we could direct it to go to his client if we wanted to?
I really mean this with respect. You're the court. You can pretty much order what you want. You could say, I think this person should pay $5,000 to the criminal defense fund, to the children's fund of whatever, to the OLR, to a former client, because it would be a sanction that you've decided is the just and right thing to do.
Okay.
And so in this case, you could order monetary payment from Mr. Anderson to whatever.
This is the way I see it. I see it that you're not interested in getting involved in restitution. I see it that you've come up on page 10 and 11 with your, what you refer to as OLR's policy to seek restitution only in four categories. I don't recall ever seeing this policy or affirming this policy, and I don't intend to affirm this policy in this case. My colleagues may, but I sure don't. I look at cases, I just pulled one here. Disciplinary proceedings against Donald Mueller. And among other things, Mueller failed to timely file and pay inheritance tax, resulting in late charges of approximately $2,000 being assessed against the estate. And so we ordered that Mueller make restitution for that amount. And if the Mueller case came before me today, when you had, and because that amount was incurred, it says, as a loss of his unprofessional conduct. And if you had that case come before me today, and it was a liquidated amount, and that I have understood for a long time was your policy, and there's good reason for it to be a liquidated amount, it's uncertain. But just like in the Mueller case, if that case, if Mueller was here today, and if I had more time, I'd go pull more. When there is a sum certain that's owing as a direct, quote, as a result of unprofessional conduct, I would order that restitution. But your policy that I'm seeing for the first time today would suggest otherwise.
Thank you, Justice. And in fact, you've proven the fallibility of my memory. I didn't recall the Mueller case and don't, but I actually had a case, John Langer, that involved late fees and in some kind of an estate matter. I think it was in the 90s, and the court ordered Mr. Langer to make some payments to the estate. So in addition to the Grapsis case, there's going to be a couple. I'm certainly not here to argue with the court or tell the court it's without authority to take certain actions. We sat down, and Keith Saleen developed and has been utilizing that restitution policy. I would believe for probably about the last year and a half to 2 years. Perhaps a lot of those cases haven't hit the court. I know that in a Linda Smith case that was decided a couple of years ago, that policy was recited verbatim before the court, and I believe it has been since, which is why Ms. Falk, when she authored this brief, set forth that policy.
Didn't cite any authority for it other than OLR's policy.
It's, I'm telling you, there is not. Our job is to try to assist the court in doing justice, and we do the best we can in making our decisions, as the court is going to do the best it can in making its. We'll respect precedent. The court may feel that certain situations may fall outside of what OLR might see as the normal precedent, and again, no disrespect intended, and what you do and what you order, well, that's the right result. And then we know that that's what should be done in the Smith case or the Jones case or the Anderson case. I will say that there is a lot of lack of clarity with regard to amount, and although, you know, again, we ask for restitution a lot and in a lot of matters, but I hearken back to a case, it's one of the Don Harmon cases, it was from 1987, and the court said, an order for restitution here is inappropriate, for it would convert the disciplinary proceeding into a trial on the issue of damages, something for which the disciplinary procedure is neither designed nor fitting. Is that 20 years ago? It is, but what I'm saying is I don't know that there are other avenues for people to resolve disputes other than figuring out restitution within OLR cases.
That's right, absolutely. And that point is well taken, and it's one that I think has been honored by this court and OLR, because we are not to be a mini trial on the amount of restitution. But when there is a liquidated amount, a sum certain, we've taken a different approach.
I understand, and I know my time is approaching, and the court has been very patient, and I'd say although there was a liquidated seeming amount listed, there's some question about the underpinnings of that. And these cases are tough, and I listen to, and you listen to Mr. Anderson, and they're not about exacting punishment, but they are about trying to do the right thing, and to us respecting the court's precedent. And that's why we're asking you to issue a final order, making the findings and conclusions of the referee. We think the right result is a 60-day suspension, whether it's a 90-day, whether it's a public. There's always that argument about a range. But I appreciate your time, and did not mean to argue with the court, but rather discuss the case before it.
In criminal law, restitution says you have to look at the amount of loss suffered by the victim, the financial resources of the defendant, present and future earning ability of the defendant, the needs and earning ability of the defendant's dependents, and any other factors which the court deems appropriate. In determining restitution under attorney discipline, do we look at the financial resources of the defendant? Should we or look at the present future earning ability of the defendant? The needs and earning ability of the defendant's dependents?
I think the purposes in some respects of the criminal justice system and procedure and the attorney disciplinary procedures differ. And I guess if I would be so bold, so if I were the court, I'd say I don't think I'd look at that much. I'd try to make a restitution order that was fair. Now, if an attorney is demonstrably unable to make those payments, not unwilling, but unable, I think that I'd have to then modify or reconsider the validity of the order, or whether or not and how it should be enforced. If an amount is fair, that X owes Y $20, then X owes Y $20, and even if X doesn't have it, I might be inclined to make that as being a fair order.
Now, generally, we give it the whole restitution, and then if they can't pay, it comes up on whether they should be admitted back in, usually if there's over a six-month period.
We try to monitor the court's orders and post-discipline compliance, including restitution, and you try to work with people and get them to pay what they can and will, and that's a struggle. And I suppose the bottom line is perhaps having to bring those matters back before the court to say we don't think she's paying enough, she should be able to pay more, but we've generally been able to avoid that situation.
Thank you, Mr. Weigel. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. The court is in recess until, I think, May 22, when we have another OLR case. The court will meet in conference now.